History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Decades ago, massive corporations roamed the earth, like JCPenney, Sears, Kodak, and Blockbuster, that have gone completely extinct or exist today in very, very diminished forms. And this is the cycle of business. The average corporation that's in the S&P 500 is only there for about a decade or so. So as entirely lawful industries are disrupted out of existence, why is it that some organized crime syndicates have lasted for over a century, even though there's billions of dollars of law enforcement opposition and rivals that want to destroy them? In this podcast, I've talked about organized crime before, specifically in the context of Max Weber's idea of a monopoly of violence, that only people that can use violence in a society are typically the government. Only they can have police that are armed. Only they can have militaries. A private person can't raise a private military and attack people without any consequences. Now, this is an only ideal type because in any society, there are gangs and other criminal syndicates that use violence on their own terms. Today's guests are microeconomists Gerald Zimmerman and Daniel Forrester. They're the author of the new book, The Forensics of Mobsters' Business Practices, and they look at mafia and organized crime not through the lens of a legal framework or moral framework, but simply how they operate as a business so that we can perhaps learn some lessons from them, but more importantly, understand them so we can do what we need to do as a society to mitigate their influence and perhaps eliminate them. They look at how the Sinaloa cartel, the American mafia, the Hells Angels, the Crips, and the Blood survive, and even thrive, where legal companies that play by the rules falter and fail. The reason is that all successful, lawful, and unlawful organizations have to follow the same fundamental economic principles: assign tasks, measure outcomes, reward performance, and cultivate corporate culture. And a successful criminal enterprise can create a high-performance team with enduring corporate culture and strong brands. They attract the right people while purging vampires, or the people that take from more rather than contribute to an organization. So by looking at criminal enterprises in this unique way, there's really a lot to learn from here. How does the American Mafia successfully set up corporate franchises? How do the Hells Angels have a strong brand identity? So there's a lot of really interesting ways here to look at these criminal organizations, and I got a lot out of this discussion, and I hope you do too, in this analysis of the corporate culture of criminal enterprises with Gerald Zimmerman and Daniel Forrester. Right, Jerry and Daniel, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having us. It's a real pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you, Scott. Yeah.
Well, I'm really excited to look at this because from a historical perspective, I've looked at a lot at organized crime because some historians and political scientists argue that the governments we have today were basically the winners among different political factions that really aren't that much different from organized crime. They just happened to rise to the top and evolve and have a monopoly on violence. And here we are today. And I looked at the Ottoman Empire, which definitely had blurred lines between legitimate government and organized crime. But to start off, before we look at the specific case studies, I'm curious about what made the two of you interested in this particular book topic to look at organized crime, not from a legal perspective or a moral perspective of which it's normally approached, but from a microeconomic perspective.
Let me start and then I'll let Daniel fill in the blanks. The project started as a convergence of my teaching and research on the general topic of corporate governance and my avocation with organized crime. I always liked watching those kinds of movies, The Sopranos, The Godfather, The Wire, and it always struck me as a bit problematic as how do some of these organized crime syndicates last, in the case of the American Mafia, over 100 years now, when legitimate businesses fail. An average company listed on the New York Stock Exchange only is there for about 10 or 12 years before it either is bought up or goes out of business. So what is the corporate governance structure of these organized crime families that allows them to survive? And corporate governance is the study of how do companies attract, retain, and motivate a self-interested workforce to achieve the company's objectives. And all legal and illegal organizations have that same problem. And what, as microeconomists have done, is understand that corporate governance mechanisms have to be there to align the incentives of your workers with the company's strategy. And so I just applied those same economic principles to these organized crime families. About halfway through the project, I started doing a little work with Daniel, told him about the project, and he got very excited and said, wait, you're missing a key piece here, and that's the corporate strategy piece. And so that was really Daniel's contribution.
Scott, I'll just say, you know, when Jerry presented me with an early manuscript, everything I learned at the University of Rochester, everything I believe about microeconomics, but the cultures of these groups that we've studied, these are microcultures that actually have brands, they have brand recognition, they've modernized themselves, as I'm sure we will get into in this conversation. And one of the things that fascinates me as a strategist is strategy and culture to me are entwined in any organization in a never-ending dance. Culture is the way things are done around here, and the Hell's Angels don't do it any different. They do it very differently than the mafia does, than the cartels do it as well. So a chance to do a deep dive there. And yes, you have to sort of suspend animation here, and you have to realize that these are groups of people that do value violence, and that is a value set. It's not something that Jerry and I particularly value. We have other things and other things we gain utility from, but it was fascinating to go deep within it and to take the bookends of everything that microeconomics teaches us about whether you're running Goldman Sachs or you're running a country, even to understand how those micro factors, but the micro culture and connecting it to the strategic persistence of these organizations was just fascinating to me. And I'm a sucker for a Goodfellas on any Saturday night on TNT myself, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, nobody can deny it. If you're not drawn into mafia fictionalized, come on, you're a liar. And I really like your perspective because in the past on this show, when I've talked about monopoly on violence, the Max Weber idea that a government only has a legitimate means of violence used in police forces or militaries, that's a mental model that doesn't exist anywhere in the world. There's always gaps in that, and people will rush to fill in that vacuum, like the Hell's Angels or the Mafia. But they're not all powerful, even though they wield violence. They have to use the authority. Authority comes from the consent of the governed, to use constitutional verbiage. And Hell's Angels have to do outreach and public relations in their own special way. But of course, you know that better. So let's look in the particular cases and dive in, and then you can explicate these principles as we're also looking at these real life case studies. And I'd love to hear first about the Hell's Angels, probably something I would understand the best. People in my family are motorcycle fans. They're not bikers by any means, but you know, I'm in the Midwest. I see them go by and I can see the full patch in the fronts and the guys without the patches on their back in the back. So I kind of get it a little bit. So let's start off with the Hell's Angels. How do they operate microeconomically?
The Hell's Angels is, according to the founder, Sonny Barger, they weren't founded to do organized crime. They are a biker club that contains criminals. And so they are very, very different than the other three crime syndicates that we study. But they have a very strong brand. Some clubs are very engaged almost entirely in criminal activities. Others are, it's more of a brotherhood. It's a saloon culture. It is being with your brothers, writing, partying. And so they are very unique among the other three. And they're not very successful as organized criminals because they don't make very much money. They spend a lot of time fighting among other clubs. And they basically do drug deals and gun deals as a way of sustaining some income.
Yeah. And well, I'm curious. So why aren't they successful? Is it because because I would think, all right, they're a highly mobile group. If it comes to trafficking, you think they could do that very well. Is it because they don't have a sophisticated distribution network? They don't have a lot of capital. How would you describe their weaknesses in that sense?
Well, if you go back and you read Sonny Barger's autobiography, they limit the club size to 20 to 25 members because they want to become a very tight-knit organization. And once they get more than 20 to 30 members, they'll spin off a separate, another club. And therefore, it's very hard to acquire all of the skills you need if you limit the size of your organization to 20 people. And not all of them are doing drugs or, and crimes. You compare that to the American Mafia, that one of the New York City families would have maybe 500 members, and then there's a lot of associates. And so by limiting the scale in order to accomplish their strategy, and again, the strategy of the Hell's Angels is to be tough and to be a righteous biker and to get out on the road and ride your bike and party all night. Those are not the ingredients to make a successful crime syndicate.
But it's interesting there, just to add to it, what we realize is that people don't just value economics and one more dollar, Scott. I mean, there, Jerry tees it up really well. The folks that are attracted to something like the Hell's Angels, they value camaraderie. They value that ability to have an open frontier, to be wild with each other, and that connection with one another, which it's a theme across all four of these groups, by the way, over-indexing completely as males, which is a real interesting part of it. And there's something about, to Jerry's point, when the size of the group gets to 25, it sort of dissipates. But make no mistake, culturally, they're extremely successful. If you value partying, if you value camaraderie, if you value the idea that the road is yours to take with your brothers, this is a highly successful organization. Is it as economically successful as others? Perhaps not. But remember, people have insatiable needs and desires, not just to make one more dollar.
And there's a book I read several years ago called No Angel, about an undercover officer who infiltrates the Hell's Angels because he's trying to take them down in a RICO case. And exactly like you said, what the Hell's Angels provided was, if you weren't with them, you might just be a lonely old man who's a biker who's counting nickels at the end of the bar trying to get another Budweiser. But with them, you have a patch, you have respect in that world. So with Hell's Angels, from an economic perspective, let's say we have a consultant with Deloitte who maybe gets addicted to methamphetamines and falls off the rail and joins the Hell's Angels. So they're a biker now, but he still has all of the knowledge of corporate consulting and how to build up an organization. So what would this Deloitte-turned Hell's Angels say to the Hell's Angels of, okay, listen, I have some spreadsheets here. This is how we need to restructure your organization so that you can be up there with the MS-13. You can be a highly successful gang that Cosa Nostra, whatever. So what would you say to the Hell's Angels to build them up?
Don't let that guy in.
Okay.
because their culture, as Daniel described it, and what they really value is being able to get on their motorcycles and spend 3 or 4 days riding across the country on July 4th and on these other holidays. Now, if you're out partying all night long and riding your bike, how do you generate income? You don't. You're consuming. And so they value very different things than people in the mafia. So to your hypothetical, that guy knocks on the door of the Hell's Angels and starts telling them he wants to change them. Well, he's not going to get through the front door.
He's not. You know, it makes me think, Scott, Jerry and I, in our conversations, we talked a lot about other groups that are different morally, for sure, like the military, and how much the military gains utility from this unbelievable loyalty, fidelity, steadfastness, the ability to handle pressure. They're not necessarily, if you're in the military, you're not intrinsically motivated by the next spreadsheet that Deloitte consultant put into the room. You value something. I've been studying the Masons. The Masons still exist, this incredibly secretive group that's still out there, and they're trying to gain their next generation of relevancy too. And the Masons, you know, attract and retain members to their organization because there's an esprit de corps and there's a connection with it. Not something I'm attracted to, but it does. These groups tend to linger in these not just always economic. Yes, you need money in order for the enterprise to survive. And by the way, maybe the Hells Angels are not the best product orientation group. Some of the other groups we studied, I was astounded as Jerry and I got into this of how customer centric some of these organizations are, how fast the schemes come up. But make no mistake, the Hells Angels has a brand, has a reputation. They operate, and this is a model we put into the book in a few parts. In culture, you think about symbol, action, and rhetoric. The symbols of each of these groups are very iconic. And in fact, actually, those identities are monetizable. Action is how they go about the craft of living out their values, and rhetoric precedes it as part of the storytelling consciousness in the background. So the Hells Angels, perhaps a bit of an outlier, but no different than the groups such as the Masons or even the U.S. military branches that value something different than the almighty dollar.
But let me add one thing to your point, Scott. You started off by talking about that some of these criminal organizations, or some of these governments that you've studied, are basically criminal organizations. The interesting thing about the Hells Angels is that they have developed a corporate governance mechanism to protect the brand and the strategy of the Angels. Turns out that the Oakland chapter of the Angels is called the Mother Club. And if another club anywhere in the world starts to debase the brand, the mother club can yank its charter, meaning that they can't wear the patch. And so the Hells Angels do have a strong incentive and mechanisms to prevent their members doing things that would cause the brand to be diminished.
Yeah, I was thinking of a governance structure. At first, I was going to say a feudal system where you have lords and they have their own fief, but then there's a king on top to control it. But it sounds more like a tribal confederacy where you have tribes, they're splintering and refracturing and reforming, and they can link up together. You can have someone at the very top, but that very decentralized nature seems more of a tribal confederacy than even a feudal system. But I don't know. That was my take. If you can, you know this better than I do.
If we take that idea, your idea, into the American Mafia,
yes,
here you do have very decentralized captains who are running crews of made men, and they're doing heists and all sorts of different rackets. But there is a hierarchy, and sitting on top of each of these families is just call him the boss of the family, to keep it simple. And his entire role is to adjudicate disputes among family members. And so if two made men get in a fight over something and they can't resolve it themselves, they go to the boss, and the boss's word is final. But then the boss of these families also, they form this thing called the commission, which is like the board of directors across the five families. And they, again, were a judicial body that resolved disputes among the various families. And also they ran the cartel, if you want. So, for example, when Nevada legalized gambling in Las Vegas, the commission quickly made a decision that said, okay, we're going to make Las Vegas and Nevada open territory, meaning that any family can go do whatever they set up, whatever casino they want. And so, to your point, these organized crime syndicates do take on these quasi-governmental structures, which they have to do to solve their corporate governance problems.
Well, to come back to a point made earlier, that these organized crime groups are amazingly rapid when they measure outcomes, they reward performance. Did you have the American Mafia in mind when you were talking about that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so please tell me more about that.
Say that, phrase that again.
For the book, when you're talking about the economic principles that for all these groups, that they assign tasks, they measure outcomes, they reward performance, and they cultivate a corporate culture. And it sounds like the American Mafia is very emblematic of those things. So please tell me more about that. Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
The American Mafia looks a lot like a franchise, McDonald's franchised organization, whereby the individual crews, once you become a made man and you're accepted into the family, you report to a captain. And in fact, the only way to get into the mafia is for one captain to nominate you, usually after 10 or 15 years of working the streets as an associate. And that captain then is responsible for you as long as the captain is in the family. So if you become a snitch, the first thing the family does is kill your captain. So this provides pretty strong incentives for the captain to follow pretty closely what all of his people are doing. So the task assignments are that the made men who have associates with them have fairly broad decision-making authority within their vice. So, for example, if you're running truck hijacking out of a port of New York City, you basically have the sole decision-making responsibility as to what trucks you're going to heist and how you're going to deal with the ill-gotten loot. And so people who get really good at spotting lucrative cargoes get wealthy because they get to keep usually 80% of the value of what's stolen. They pass the rest up the chain, just like a McDonald's passes 5 or 10% of its revenue up to the corporate offices. They then have these very strong incentive systems because they eat most of what they kill. Well, no pun intended here. They have strong incentives to find lucrative projects. And at the same time, being in the mafia affords them so much prestige in their local community that they want to stay loyal and profitable so that they can move up the chain to be promoted to captain and maybe boss at some point.
You know, and Scott, from a cultural perspective, I can't tell you how fascinating it was to go back and forth with my mentor here and ask the question, what are the core values of the mafia? Just think about how you'd answer that question. And, you know, we put at least four into play here. Steadfastness, resourcefulness, loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. These are particularly the mafia, right? Takes corporate loyalty to a level. We even had conversations, Jerry and I were talking about. He said to me one day, Daniel, how easy is it to get hired in your company? I said, oh, Jerry, it's incredibly hard to get hired in my company. I make you take a test. I check your references. I'm really doing a down selection. I was so proud to tell him that, you know, less than 1% of people or 2% of people that apply to my small business actually get through. And he says, well, what's the elapsed time that it takes you to do that? And I said, well, we can't allocate tons of resources against this, Jerry. And he said, could you imagine an interview process that takes 5, 10, 12 years in order for you to create and escalate into the organization? And obviously, that's not something that we think our lawful leaders can copy. But it does make you think about the intentionality of onboarding, of who you're attracting into the firm, of how much time and attention. I do a lot of work with organizations that their products these days are knowledge products, where their knowledge worker is selling. So that idea of and my best advice is you study someone like the mafia, what can a lawful leader take from it? Just think about your interview process and how low the bar might be. Think about how much you're not attracting in people who, as Simon Sinek once said, you want to attract people who believe what you believe. Again, I don't know that I'd be in business if I had 9 years to onboard my first manager into the company. But when Jerry sat me down and said, let's really take a look at this, I thought to myself, my lawful leaders can learn a lot from that.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit more of that, because what your book does is make somebody think differently about organized crime. I mean, when we think about the American mafia, where most of us are imagining Martin Scorsese movies and a bunch of tough guys roughing people up and murders and made men and all that. And of course, that's a part of it. I mean, that's what makes the mafia distinct. But then there's all sorts of other things, community outreach, building up the trust and the support of the community, because they do need to have that community compliance. You can't always intimidate. If you're only doing that, then you're like ISIS, where people will turn on you the first second they can because they don't like you and they want you out. But the mafia didn't do that. So What are things that you think would surprise people about the mafia when you're looking at it from this different perspective, purely from an economic perspective?
One thing I would say that I learned from doing this is the violence is not nearly as prevalent as the movies make it out to be. Mm-hmm. And because the vast majority of these people use violence very sparingly. Physical violence is typically not good for business. You don't want to kill your customers unless they really do something very, very bad. And so that was one lesson. And the other, you know, they adopt very sensible policies that take the long run view. You know, unlike corporate America, public companies are reporting on a quarterly basis. These guys never report. Mm-hmm. And so they take the long view, and they take the long view by having policies like, we're never going to kill a law enforcement agent or a judge. We're going to bribe them. But if we kill them, that's going to impose far more costs on us. And it's very, very bad for business. So they have these policies that take the very long run view. It's very unusual for somebody like a John Gotti, who killed Paul Castellano, to move up in the ranks. And in fact, they came up with the commission idea to solve a lot of the warfare across them. If you compare that to what's going on in Mexico, there is no commission or overarching body that controls the violence across these different drug cartels. And we see the difference. We see the enormous amount of killing and violence in Mexico. And even at the worst part, even in the 40s and 50s and 60s, at the height of the mafia's power in the United States, the number of killings, you know, were probably under 5 or 10 a year.
And that's an excellent point. And if listeners want to go back in the archives for this show, there's one about the role of the mafia in city political machines. And I live in Kansas City. We have a very rich history of that with Tom Pendergast and others. And switching gears a little bit, I'd like to look at another group that is focused on in your book, and that is inner city gangs. They come about in the latter half of the 20th century. So what causes them to come about, and what is the need that they're fulfilling in a community? Because if they weren't fulfilling one, they wouldn't exist. And yeah, so please walk me through that.
Well, the inner city gangs started really after World War II, when the Black community started to really go downhill for a variety of socioeconomic reasons. But we now have this large community of basically single parent households, and these young boys who don't have strong father figures, who are getting beaten up on the streets, often by white kids. And so they formed these Black gangs to protect their Black communities from racists coming in. And the police back in the 50s and 60s were not providing the adequate protection for them. So these gangs started just as self-preservation, and also, like the Hells Angels, a sense of belonging. They really didn't turn, you know, they were doing petty crime, but not a lot. And what really supercharged them was the introduction of crack cocaine. Crack cocaine was very cheap to make. It had high profit margins. And all of a sudden, some of these street gangs, not all of them, but some of them suddenly had a source of income that they could buy a bag of powder cocaine for a few hundred dollars and turn it into several thousand dollars of crack. And so, again, they're more like the Hell's Angels in that they're providing safety, a social network, camaraderie, much like the Hell's Angels. And they're really not organized as well as the mafia.
You know, just to add on top of that, there's a meta story, Scott, in across all of these family, the connection to family and loyalty and fidelity to family, feeling that sense of belonging or the absence of family. That's sort of another character in the book here, right? Because people come up from different, you know, various parts of our country various mechanisms to become one of these types of unlawful group. And again, you know, what does this have to do with our lawful leaders? There's not a CEO that I work with that doesn't lament the day when one employee walks out the building. And especially when you've spent an inordinate amount of time attracting them, incentivizing them. And if you're in the business of knowledge work, for example, the day one of your employees leaves, the specific knowledge that you helped to co-create with them in their consciousness is out the door. So there's much for our lawful leaders to learn here, not so much, and companies use this idea, we are more like a family. I'd be very careful about that, by the way. I tell our CEOs, I have one family and my wife gets to say certain things to me in my family, but you know, most of my company, I do believe in collaboration and community. Even the business roundtable, by the way, had to reconcile in 2019, what is the firm? What does the firm really stand for? And they described it as a multi-stakeholder community aspect of it. It's employees, it's unions, it's the context of our communities. It's not just shareholder primacy. But there's something here for our leaders, lawful leaders, to meditate on, to ask, how are you doing creating that fidelity, that connection to the firm, to your organization, given, Scott, that you and I are going to spend an inordinate amount of our lives in contributing to some economic cause. And we know from the data, particularly among the millennial generation, they want to work in organizations that have similar value sets and believe what they believe. And by the way, that lowers the cost of turnover. So that's one of the reasons that I put that into the room here. As you look at these various groups, there's so much for our lawful leaders to just pull back and reflect on. They're probably not going to value violence the way these groups do, but there is something about what we call being intentional and giving management attention to things like, what is our culture and why do we give anyone a reason to stay? These groups do an enormously powerful job at making sure not only that they keep and take that long view Jerry was talking about, but they want to retain. They want to retain because of connection. And so there's something there in the ether, I think, for our leaders to really ponder.
One thing too, as you've described the differences in these groups, the positive benefits of that come to mind are more from the American Mafia than these other groups, where you could imagine a Don adjudicating a conflict between different groups, sort of like a king holding court, where he makes a pronouncement and then that pronouncement is followed. Or Tom Pendergast, he wasn't a mafioso, but in Kansas City, he would give people turkeys on Thanksgiving Day, so people would be lined up by the thousands. And but you can't imagine the Hell's Angels doing any type of charity work or the Bloods and the Crips. Is it because these groups are more decentralized that they don't have the same stake of community involvement than other traditional American mafia does?
Well, that's really an interesting question. It was certainly the case that the American mafia in their neighborhoods were the safest places to live. Mm-hmm. You could leave your cars unlocked. If anything was stolen, you just go to your neighbor who's a friend of a friend of a friend, and it suddenly reappears. You don't have that same giving back in these other groups. And that's an interesting question that we could write an entire book about. The contrast with the Sinaloa cartel, mm-hmm, is they didn't have a strong sense of community or being part of a group. What kept everyone in line there was the enormous profits that were being generated and the incredible violence that anyone who even looks cross-eyed at somebody is going to get shot. And so it was just the fear of violence, which was the really strong motivator with the Sinaloa cartel. But they still had their own corporate governance problems. They still had to motivate people to transport the drugs across the state, across vast areas. So, you know, it's an interesting question. Maybe Daniel has a better answer than I can come up with.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
No, I think, I guess, you know, the idea for a lot of our lawful leaders, they call it, what is our, you know, our community responsibility? Do we have one? And I think Jerry just really litigated it very well. The mafia stood out, I think, demonstrably in this book as having community affiliation. And it's been interesting. Jerry and I have been exchanging emails as we're watching the behavior inside the pandemic of these groups as well. I get alerts from all these different groups every day. But to your point, Scott, even the Bloods and the Crips at time, they've had moments when between the warring factions, they have acquiesced in the sense because they're trying to pay respect or homage to someone who's passed in the community. So there is that moment of collaboration. But I do think if you were to say who's leaning into their local community building in a more systemic way, there's no doubt that the mafia demonstrates more of what our commercial leaders would call a corporate social responsibility agenda. And something else I'll just say that fascinates me, that's at the community level. To me, Jeff Bezos taught us all about this idea about being obsessed about our customers. The only way you really saw, you have to solve problems for customers. These groups astound me in how fast they are able to imagine a new scheme. Some of them don't go anywhere. Some of them, these are duds. But by the way, even in the commercial context, you've got to take a portfolio view if you're going to build a company, because not every idea that the innovation team has is going to generate the profits and the revenue streams that you want. But you certainly don't want to have a big bureaucratic process that sits on top of innovation. So what's interested me a lot as we studied the DNA and the forensics of these groups is that there isn't a lot of conversation, Scott, between you and me and Jerry. If we think we've got a noble scheme that could generate some profit, a product that none of the three of us probably would want to sell to anyone in our family, but there isn't a lot of meetings and bureaucracy slowing down innovation. So there's something there to be found, because in my work in culture, most of the time when a client says to me, we're not innovating, we're not generating enough revenue, we have to grow again. My question is, what role is bureaucracy, hierarchy, and silo mentality playing in your inability to do that? These groups, because they push out decision rights, as Jerry's talked about so beautifully throughout this, they allocate it close to the problem. And that's something also for our lawful leaders to celebrate and to learn from.
Right. That's what I'm really hearing here, that we should never underestimate the intelligence of people in a criminal organization. And they have many advantages that large bureaucracies don't. Like you said earlier, they have a good corporate culture of hiring the right people. You can, quote unquote, fire people much more easily. There's no HR you have to build up a paper trail and documentation to get somebody out. They listen to feedback, they implement. So I think to tie in a lot of these things together, my question is, what are other, I suppose, positive takeaways we should leave from these groups? But I think the crux of the matter is, and why you wrote the book, organized crime is bad. I mean, we live in a constitutional republic where the rule of law reigns. And if an institution, whether a government official, a police officer, anybody, is breaking the law, then we have a court system that in a perfect world we can go through and we can seek justice. But with organized crime, you can't really do that. So what are any other positive takeaways, and what do you hope people understand from your book so that we can mitigate organized crime?
That's a great question. The key takeaways are that every organization, be it legal or illegal, has a unique strategy. So the strategy of the Hells Angels is very different than the strategy of the Sinaloa cartel. They're supplying different products to different people. And the key takeaway is, because you have different strategies, you have to have unique corporate governance mechanisms. You have, which are those four pieces that we've talked about. You simply cannot go out and copy what your next door neighbor is doing, because your next door neighbor has a different set of objectives. So that's one key takeaway. The second key takeaway for lawful leaders is you have to understand that your customers and your workers are self-interested. They're very clever. They have a very diverse set of wants. And in order to motivate them, you have to provide incentives that matter. And the incentives that to a Hell's Angels is very different than an incentive to a Southwest pilot. And so that's the other key takeaway. And the final takeaway is there are these general principles of economics, like self-interest, like creativity, that has to be part of the design of your corporate governance. And when the world is changing like it is today, companies have to update their strategies. And as you update your strategies, you then have to update your corporate governance. And that's what these four organized crime syndicates illustrate really brilliantly, that they have different governance mechanisms today than they did 30, 40 years ago.
Scott, I'd add one more piece to it. And Jerry and I, in the back of the book, we give a blueprint for lawful leaders to say, how can you apply these concepts into your organization? One of the things we stressed a lot at the back of the book inside healthy, constructive cultures is this idea of recognition. It astounds me in my work how much when we measure culture, because culture can be measured, when we ask employees what they want more of, because of that self-interest, by the way, employee fulfillment, employee recognition always shows up. It is very rare when I measure a culture that we see that recognition is in the DNA of a culture. So what? These groups, these mobster groups, do an incredible job at recognizing one another, witnessing each other's lives. They certainly pass a lot of time and have a hell of a lot of fun together. But I will just share, if I had corporate companies taking 25% of the recognition tactics that those groups do through symbol, action, and rhetoric, as I talked about earlier, it is one of the superpowers to move your organization forward. Scott, think about any time in your life someone wrote you a note recognizing an extraordinary piece of work. I probably bet in your basement, you couldn't even throw it out. Mm-hmm. Recognition is a superpower. If you're able to activate it in a high-performing culture, our mobsters have a lot to teach lawful leaders, particularly at that level.
Let me just give you one example of that. Both the Crips, Bloods, and the Mafia, as well as Hell's Angels, they would go to jail for long periods of time rather than ratting out one of their brethren. And the reason they did that was that they knew that they would gain prestige if they went to jail. And if they went to jail, they would have other people inside the jail that would help protect them. And their illegal brotherhoods usually took care of their families outside. And so that's an enormous amount of loyalty. And very few of them only started to turn state's evidence with the RICO laws that changed the sentencing guidelines from 3 to 5 years to 30 years. So the federal government figured out how to at least reduce some of the loyalty that these organizations generated.
Well, that's an excellent principle that the two of you underlined, that if legitimate institution isn't providing for people in the way that they want, then many people will turn to illegitimate institutions. And the understanding how they are successful, I think, is extremely important. Well, there's a lot more to get into this book. And for those who want to check it out and dig much deeper into these stories and data and everything, the book is Relentless, The Forensics of Mobsters Business Practices. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dan Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.